Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
Well, as the American presidential election gets about 47% crazier by the day, the solution may be the Canada Party. And I'm joined by the Brain Trust, the War Room.
The out-of-work comedy writers.
Carville and Stephanopoulos of the Canada Party. Chris Cannon and Brian Calvert. How you guys doing?
Great. Thanks
Great.
For having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So the
The
Canada Party's declaration or maybe Precy, its book is America But Better, and you guys are in the midst of sort of a national tour about the book, but it kind of grew out of a string of articles in the Tie. Did you initially envision this as a book, or was this kind of like, let's write these articles and see where it takes us?
Well, I've been writing for the Tie for years, and mostly satire. So this didn't actually come out of those articles. We did eventually, for this book, we used two of the articles because they were just right up the alley of what we were doing. So that wasn't really related. We, Brian and I, have worked for years on doing sketch comedy, videos, journalism, all kinds of stuff, separately and together. And last fall, we decided we wanted to get into some political writing. We watched the elections in the United States get crazier and crazier, and then people like Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum putting comedy writers out of work since 2011. So we thought, let's go after this and see if we can make something of it. And that's how we came up with the idea.
Now, in terms of putting this together then, I mean, you wanted to satirize the American election in a sense, but coming up with a party and then, you know, a platform for that party, was that the first idea, or did you have kind of other kicks at it in terms of what you were going to do to satirize it?
Well, I think we had agreed that we were going to go at it with the videos, and we wanted to put out a new, basically, you know, that's when campaign videos were really starting to fire up, and they were starting to sling a little bit at each other. And we thought, well, let's use the same recognizable format, and we'll do a first one to kind of introduce the Canada Party, and then we'll just do a series of campaign ads after that with, you know, really carte blanche as to what you want to do exactly, and just have some fun with it, and maybe tackle some of the things that are coming up in the media and whatnot. We only got the first video took off to a point where by the time we were done the second video, that's when we had already kind of negotiated the sort of the possibility of expanding it into, well, what if Canada actually did sort of take it? What's the vision for the country? And that's where the manifesto came from.
The sort of basic idea is that, you know, maybe give us a try at running your country. We couldn't necessarily do worse than what you're doing, and we could probably do better. Although I think, you know, some people in Canada might say, oh, we've got our own problems right now. Could we necessarily do better? Did this, you know, weigh into the consideration about, you know, Canada as a party that, you know, getting your own ducks in a row?
Yeah, the first thing we realized is it wasn't going to be our government. I think that's what everyone thought. It was going to be the Canadian government, and essentially that makes it an invasion. And this was always set out to be an intervention, mm-hmm. which is far more Canadian way to do it anyway.
Truth.
And because there is a lot of discontentment around our own government and some of the issues that we're dealing with. So we've basically promised the American and Canadian people that once elected, we'll turn around and invade ourselves for a little regime change of our own. So both countries get to benefit.
It's a win-win situation.
Yeah.
Now, Chris, you're an American.
I am.
And, you know, conceivably, barring, you know, a whole bunch of money from lobbyists and stuff, could theoretically run for the president, whereas Canada, you know, not being born in the U.S., can't. Is this like the, you know, the first sign of knowing you have a problem is admitting it, that, you know, it might take a Canadian to run, and it's an American who's realized this?
Well, that's we feel a little bulletproof in this project because I'm American and a Canadian permanent resident, and he's Canadian who grew up right on the American border. So we both are very steeped in the culture of both countries, and we don't separate in our minds very much the Canadian people and the American people. It's sort of a little brother, big brother relationship. And so we don't feel like, you know, America can't handle it anymore. We're going to take over. We feel more like the American people have been getting screwed. And they're our brothers and sisters, and we want to help them out. We're all in this boat together. So we kind of feel like we're championing the American people, not coming in and taking over.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because your own bio, you know, intelligence, counterterrorism, Presidential Honor Guard and stuff. I mean, these are the kind of things that, you know, I think a spin doctor would ideally love to see those in a gubernatorial or Senate candidate. You know, this is the kind of background that is, golden.
I've decided to tackle the much more challenging and tear-inducing world of comedy writing. That's what I'm doing now. I've left so much of that behind. And it's funny, people always bring up my service in the Marine Corps. No one ever brings up my journalism experience, which I've done for like three times as long. And that's where I get a lot of the background that comes into this. I'm pushing all of that into comedy, and particularly work with Brian. We work so well together, and we've got so many projects on the burners that we want to expand what we're doing here, as well as other projects that we've been coming up with. So we have a very rich and full lives. So I would not want to throw that away to be in politics. I'm not a power hungry kind of guy, and I don't like being in the spotlight, really.
I assume the follow up is going to be my experience at Cub Scouts as well.
Yep.
I had a couple
military,
badges there.
Military experience.
Yeah. It's equivalent in Canada, right? A couple years of Cub Scouts, like a couple years in the military in the States.
It's service.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you mentioned the journalistic experience, and I mean, that's not something that generally gets weighed into for candidates is, you know, covering politics, right? It's usually you're either civic service or you're a business background or something like that. Those are the things that get trumpeted, but, you know, having an understanding of politics by covering it is never sort of seen as a plus or a...
Well, critical thinking is not in high demand for politicians in the United States or in Canada, from what I'm saying.
It's true.
Fortuna, I see it's like a Latin tattoo here. Is it
good thing this is radio. It's from the Aeneid, Audentes Fortuna Juvat. It's from the Book 10 of the Aeneid. It means fortune favors the bold.
I was going to say fortune favors the prepared mind as well.
Yeah, same thing. It depends on the translation. Fate favors the prepared, things like that. But yeah, it's from Book 10 of the Aeneid.
Well, I thought it was Wookiee this whole time.
Yeah.
He's kind of a sci-fi nerd, so.
You lay out a conceivably real platform of ideas for what could be done in terms of the system and repairing it, and it I think springs from this, you know, prepared mind, right? Like that you have given it some actual thought, right? Like it there's humor in it, but ultimately there's an undercurrent of reality and gut check.
Yeah, well, they say journalism is speaking truth to power, and satire, it's just another rhetorical form. Satire is speaking comedy to power. So, of course, there's a lot of real policy issues in play there. That's the nature of satire. We didn't write a book of fart jokes. And people do point out some of the stuff and say, okay, well, obviously it's satire and jokey, and that's ridiculous. Like, yeah, it's ridiculous, but it's not the plans themselves that we're pushing. It's the mindset of coming up with better solutions, coming up with rational human solutions rather than money-driven solutions and corporate-driven solutions.
Well, I mean, a lot of the best political coverage these days comes from like Colbert Report and Daily Show, right? I mean, it's
and the
satirical, the true satire is happening in sort of what's not considered satirical press, right? I mean, like that the way it's covered by Fox News and stuff is satire when you come down to it, whereas the folks that are billing themselves as satire are speaking truth to power.
Well, we have our book is divided into four sections, and one of them is called "The Irony of Being Ironic in a Post-Ironic Age." So we're living beyond the age of irony. We don't operate within a common frame of irony anymore, and so we can't even have rational debates in Congress or in the media. I mean, earlier this year there was a representative, I believe, in the United States who had posted an onion story on his on the internet. Because
believing
he thought
it was real.
It was about Planned Parenthood opening these abortion plexes where you can, you know, go and, you know, have some popcorn, see a movie, shop around and get
maybe
an abortion.
There was a spa.
Taco Bell.
Yeah. Of course. And he posted it like it was real. It's because we have moved past the age of irony. We don't recognize with we don't operate within a common frame of irony, so we don't recognize irony anymore. And that's why you've had the rise of these satire shows over the last 10 years or so. They've been so so dominant because they are able to use satire as a rhetorical device, because our capacity for rational discourse has completely been blown off the map.
Yeah, and there was a more recent one with the Republican from Maryland who told the owners of the Ravens that their player who spoke out in favor of, you know, gay rights in right. sports should be, you know, shut down.
Yep.
And at the same time, he sits on some sort of committee that recognizes Jackie Robinson and his influence on sport. And it's like, well...
Yeah. In 60 years, they're going to look ridiculous then as the people who were fighting against blacks in baseball 60 years ago. The way they look to us now, that's how these people are going to look to us in the future. And Chris Cluey wrote a fantastic
piece. His response on Deadspin was
fantastic. Deadspin, was it? Yeah, if anybody listening, go find Chris Cluey. He's a punter for the Vikings. Now one of my favorite players in the NFL, because he wrote an articulate, brilliant, witty retort to this politician who was trying to pressure the Ravens owner to discipline this player who was simply speaking out in favor of gay rights. Yeah. Or as we like to call them, rights.
Rights, yeah, I know. This is the the thing about gay marriage. It's like, well, it's marriage. It's, you know, no one gay parks their car or has gay lunch.
Well, that's the misconception about rights. Rights aren't something you assign someone. Rights are something you recognize. It's something inherent. That's the nature of rights. And so if you say, well, we don't think you're entitled to gay rights, we're not going to give you gay rights, like, I don't need you to give me gay rights. I already have gay rights. You're taking them away from me. All I want you... Can I cuss in this station?
Sure.
All I want you to do is leave me the fuck alone.
It's true.
Yeah.
The canifax that you kind of pepper the platform with, some of them based on reality, some of them clearly not. What was the sort of impetus of kind of doing that, and sort of some of them seem like jokes, but they're real, and some of them are jokes?
Yeah. Well, we definitely wanted to – there was plenty of times we just talked about this today where we, you know, we're writing something and it starts to – sort of become a little ranty because we get too steeped in the real discussion and forget the fact that we want to, you know, put more humor into it. And the canifax, kind of like the timeline at the beginning, the idea of being assuming there was going to be a lot of Americans reading this. This is who, you know, largely who it was for, and wanted them to understand a little bit more about Canada and the history we've had. And so the canifax were another way to do that outside of the timeline, where we could sprinkle them in there, and they had some truth, and then some of it was a little bit extended, and sometimes we even call ourselves on it when it comes to the Stalin one in American Exceptionalism, where we say this is true and this should be true type of thing. And then some of them are just sort of playing off of the stereotypes that Americans sort of see and expect from Canadians anyway. We're just having fun with it. But it's just another way to sort of, you know, expose a little bit of Canada, because traditionally Americans don't, and it's not exclusively, but traditionally you get the sense that a lot of them don't know what's outside the borders. You know, they don't spend a lot of time, you know, they spend their entire education learning the 50 states and the and the capitals, and then they don't really think much else about the world. And that's what has to change right now, because...
Because they think that Palestinians don't want peace and all sorts of other things that... are clearly not rooted in reality.
They think Palestine's somewhere in South America. They don't learn a lot of international geography in American schools.
So the stereotypes about Canada, is it, Brian, you seeing, you know, living on the border, seeing sort of, you know, the occasional tourists trickle in and seeing what they kind of come with in terms of preconceived notions, or is it, you know, what you've seen coming to Canada and having sort of experienced outside looking in before you came here? Or is it a combination of the two?
I remember a few instances of having discussions with people, and a lot of times everybody used to go around across the border. It was porous. We'd go over there and gas up, and just to go to fill up the car, flash your driver's license, drive through. It was no big deal. Of course, that's all changed since 9/11, but there were people that on the other side that didn't come into Canada. Like, they just never, why would I ever want to go there. What, we've got everything we need right here. This is the best place in the world. Why would we ever go to Canada? So you start to get this the sense, and talking to people, and other Canadians would bring you these stories, like, you know, they talked to somebody, and they talked to an American, and they truly believed that the 49th parallel, the weather shifted dramatically, and then it was just snow. And they had all of these, like, really extreme ideas and you know, misconceptions about what
there were
Canada
polar
was
bears
really
right across
exactly.
the
49th parallel. We live in igloos, and it were really simple sort of people, and there's no, you know, technology and all this kind of stuff. And you only need to hear a few of these to realize that there's just some truth in this. Like, there's people are perpetuating this. And I mean, yeah, why would you want to go visit a place with igloos? I guess I don't know.
Everything I know about Canada, I learned from South Park. It's the flappy heads, the, hey, buddy, let's be friends, eh? And then I moved to Canada 7 years ago and found out it's all exactly true. It's the everything from the flappy heads to the friendliness to the streets or yellow brick roads and that kind of thing. Of course, I live in Vancouver, and it's like Willy Wonka land.
But Lotus Land, I believe, is the...
I fell in love with it. I just fell in love with it. I've spent my whole life traveling around the world, and... Vancouver is the place to end up. Like, I absolutely thrilled. I married a handsome Canadian woman, settled in Vancouver, and that's where Brian and I live and work now.
Handsome.
Yeah, she hates it when I say
that. I was going to say.
That's why I say it, is because she's calling me handsome. Well, she's a model. It's funny because she's really quite gorgeous. And
yeah,
so,
not a handsome part about it.
Yeah, there's nothing handsome about her except her husband. Mm-hmm.
So the you mentioned American exceptionalism, and you know, the mentality of why would I ever leave this country? That there's no reason. Everything else sucks compared to this, and that seems to be kind of the root problem you're trying to address in some ways in the platform. Is that, you know, a lot of the problems with the America stem from this continued belief, even when facts point otherwise, right? Education, life expectancy, you know. Yeah, you lead the world in terms of developing, you know, erection drugs, but healthcare isn't necessarily just, you know, about having a 4-hour erection.
Not just.
Well,
I
mean,
part of it though,
predominantly, but not just.
It's a major problem if you watch any football on Sundays.
There's also the 5-hour erection that we need to address. Yeah.
We're working on that.
I think we need to put an erection on the moon, right? Isn't that the next thing?
That's right. We need the Canada arm up there. The Canada-penis.
Using that thing, yeah.
So, I mean, this is clearly rooted in looking at the states outside looking in, that this is a genuine problem. And I know that, you know, when the newsroom debuted, that opening rant that Jeff Daniels goes on about, you know, what's so great about America? Why is America the best? It's not. Here's the facts about why it's not. And
yeah, the data doesn't match up to the attitude. And it's sad. I love the news. I love Aaron Sorkin. I watched the first few episodes of the newsroom. I've been taping it since, but I can't watch it because it just makes me relive the Tea Party days. And so it's depressing and exhilarating at the same time. And it's just too much for me. I love Aaron Sorkin. I feel like I'm betraying him by not watching that. But it's I don't need that trip down Tea Party memory lane.
It's hard to watch in that
sense. It's really hard. It's hard to watch that kind of mania because it's all based on real news stories that we've already had to go through. The last couple of years of discourse in American politics has been numbing.
That's one of the major complaints about what's happening in the Republican Party right now, is that, you know, they had to swing very, very right to satisfy the Tea Party. That's not necessarily going to get you elected, but it's not going to find you a candidate either. You know, how do you deal with something like that, where there's this, like, I mean, because it works in Canada, where, you know, this plurality means divide and conquer, and if you get like your core 30% or something, and there's like three other squads splitting the vote, mm-hmm. as long as you can rely on that, you can win. But you know, it's really two parties. One lobbyist with two heads, but
the Democrats are as much to blame. I mean, the Republicans swang to the right, the Democrats swang to the middle, and they should have held the ground on the left. They just gave and gave and gave, and now the most Reagan-esque president of my recollection is Obama. Now he's a conservative Reagan-esque Republican because the Republicans have swung so far to the right, and it's just given in instead of standing your ground. So there's plenty of room for blame across both parties in the U.S.
I found it interesting that, you know, Clinton is now the most popular ex-president, considering, you know, the black cloud that he left office under, and the fact that he, you know, was going to be impeached and the first president to do so. And I mean, is that you know, because those were halcyon days during that period before things went to pot, or
what's... People recognize he's a good president, and I think people are also letting go of some of the silliness around things like sex scandals. Like, I feel personally betrayed by Clinton because of the sex scandal. But you can't deny that he was one of the greatest presidents in American history. The way he left the country in such great shape, he presided over the greatest economic boom in American history. He left office. The next president in 8 years took the largest surplus in American history and turned into the largest deficit in American history. That takes work. That's a lot of effort. So
spendy.
Yeah. But I think people are letting go of the personal things. I mean, it's like watching football. Like, I keep talking to my friend about Brett Favre, and she keeps feeling really betrayed by Brett Favre and how he left the game and stuff, and kind of make, you know,
and send some dong photos.
Yeah. Well, there was that, but that I think that was just silly nonsense. I'm thinking more of like he and his wife were kind of criticizing Green Bay when they were leaving because they weren't treated well and such. But, you know, I had 16 years following Brett Favre in Green Bay, and I loved it. And he's never going to be my buddy. He's my quarterback, you know, and he was a great quarterback, and that's what I love about him. So you have to partition that, just like the people in your lives, you know. You can't look for perfect people. You can only look for perfect moments. And Bill Clinton, as far as a president goes, was an amazing president. As far as a person, you know, I don't want to be his buddy anymore, but I don't want to elect buddies. I want to elect somebody who's going to be a good president.
I find that interesting. You say you can't, you know, perfect people. You can't have perfect people. That you're proposing a party that's made up of, you know, a huge wash of people. Is that kind of a weird way of preventing the fact that there are no perfect people? Is that, you know, in the aggregate, people can be great in terms of, you know,
that's what
the different skills and the different things they bring to the table?
That's what democracy is, but the democracies have been bought out systematically by the corporations, by the corporate media, that kind of thing. So we need to put the people back in charge. And again, this is all about championing the American people and getting them their media back, getting them their government back. They're the ones that are getting screwed, and they're the ones that we're championing here.
Yeah, their voice, yeah.
Brian,
we dedicate the book to the American people. I mean, the dedication of the book is to the American people. They are an exceptional country. It brought up American exceptionalism. The American people are exceptional, and we want to return them to a state where they can be exceptional. They have the power to be exceptional, and they're no longer misinformed and taken advantage of.
Certainly. Brian, you've got your copy open, and I notice you've got a passage marked. Out of curiosity, what's the marking about? What's the
he
passage?
Underlines all the dirty words.
Yeah, I like the dirty word. Now, it comes into this discussion about the difference between patriotism, which is loving who you are, and nationalism, which is hating, you know, what is not you, type thing.
Jingoistic.
And this is right from the book. Practicing nationalism under the guise of patriotism is kind of like saying you don't hate homosexuals because they're gay; you hate them because they're not straight. I mean, it starts to sort of blend all of this together.
It's
to
the
point
same
where
sort of attitude and approach to things, and it's creating others and putting yourself over them in some way, right? Like that, you know, I can love Canada, think it's a great country, but I'm not going to go out and beat my chest and say, like, we're better than Thailand and, you know, Singapore and Kenya or something, right? Like, that doesn't lift Canada up in any way.
Well, no,
like,
and they don't, you know, and again, this isn't, when we say they don't, we're not talking about all of the American people, but the people who are standing up and pounding their chest and saying, repeatedly saying this is the greatest country in the world, is nobody wants to hang out with that guy. Like, if you put it on a humanity scale, like, who wants to hang out with the guy who thinks he's better than everybody else all the time and reminds you constantly of it?
Meanwhile, he's hassling gays and beating up women. And
yeah, like if the UN was like a high school or something. Like, you
yeah,
know,
well, that's what it looks like, a high school. Yeah.
That bully who, like, you know, people talk about behind his back. And
yeah, and they fear him, but they don't respect him. And that's truly how it's gotten. And maybe it's a fact that this is part of the outside looking in advantage that we have. But we're just one country, and we're one of the ones that are actually, you know, don't hate America. Now you expand that all over the world, where there's countries that have true beefs with them, and there's a lot more intervention by the U.S. into other countries' policies and things, and you can see why they become, you know, disliked, and there's this sort of energy against America. And the thing is, they're doing it themselves. You can't. You know, you're not going to be able to grow and move forward unless you admit what you've got, your shortcomings, and what's wrong. And they just won't. They just keep saying, well, we're the greatest country in the world. Like, that's all we need to say, right? Then it's true. If we just say it enough and say it loud enough, then then it's all true. And everyone else is going, whispering over on the side because, you know, they are intricately linked to a lot of countries and foreign aid and success and security in terms of allies. So you don't want to piss them off and tell them. And I think this was kind of one of the nice things we like to draw to this is that, you know, they need somebody to tell them they look fat in those pants. And
they look fat in any pants.
And we're the ones. Like, and the thing is you hate to hear it, but at the end,
you're hearing it from a friend.
Thank you, because now I won't go out and everybody else is going to be thinking it and not tell me. So it's like, it's hard to hear, but guess what? Some truth.
It's a self-esteem issue, and we kind of use this trope over and over of taking the keys and driving. You know, they've been drinking and drilling. We'll take the keys and drive and take them home, put them to bed, prop up their pillows, feed them some soup, and help them get healthy till they get back on their feet, because we're the little brother, and that's our job. That's what we're here. What's what we're here to do. And that's part of the conversation about American exceptionalism. The louder you're screaming about American exceptionalism, the more you're hiding faults, and the data simply does not bear out the greatest country in the world anymore. The mightiest country, absolutely, when your military strength is greater than like the next 10 greatest nations combined. Being mighty does not make you great. Being good makes you great. The proper use of that might to bring out greatness in other and others, that's what makes you great. And you cannot call yourself exceptional or the greatest country in the world if you're not willing to admit your shortcomings. And that's what we hope, that's probably the main thing we hope to bring to this whole this intervention, is the Canadian notion of humility and saying, look, you know, you're only great if you're admitting your faults and saying, I want to be better. If you're not trying to be better, then you are not great.
I want to kind of pivot away from that and talk about something that I found near the end of the book that I found fascinating. And I mean, it comes in an area where you're, you know, being funny, but there's, you know, this kernel of really cogent thought about the separation of, like, the battle between science and religion. And
if it was cogent thought, we probably lifted it from somebody else.
Well, what I found interesting was, you know, you kind of talk about, like, we use science to kind of explain our world, but religion or faith we use to kind of give larger purpose to that world.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than the two being, you know, antithetical or enemies. And I was curious about sort of the root of that thought and what, you know, you guys.
Yeah, I can just read that paragraph if you like.
Perfect.
Makes it easier. This is just right in the middle of the chapter. Science versus religion. Spoiler, science wins in overtime. Beware any candidate that tells you that God and science are on the opposite sides of a mud pit in some universal tug of war. Science is the means by which we grow as a civilization, and faith unites us as a community to make that growth mean something. They are no more in conflict than the gravitational forces between the Earth and the Moon, each steadying the orbit of the other, but governed by different atmospheric rules, which is why attempting to prove the existence of God makes faith as useless as a lunar hurricane monitor, while praying for divine intervention in our daily lives reduces God to a concierge with attention deficit disorder. Brian, you want to take that?
Yes, I agree. The church and state debate has been going on for a long time, and it seems like each administration, each election, they always talk about it, and they use them as positions to try to appeal to a certain electorate. Yeah, but nothing ever really progresses. Nothing really moves forward. And now it's even worse to the point where we're not really trying to find a resolution. It's just a matter of which one of us is going to win. The abortion debate is certainly the top of that. So there's now with science and technology, there is sort of even a greater demand for separating those things, we think, which is why we came up with the Department of Faith and the Department of Reason, which would take care of these things that are related to faith, which mostly is, you know, the poor lady who's spending 25% of her pension for her church. She needs to know exactly where that money's going. There needs to be a level of transparency there, which the Department of Faith would take care of, protect her from any sort of, and then the Department of Reason is things like NASA and math, you know, things that have some sort of empirical basis that are important to go forward. And now there's an attack on science as well with global warming and deniers of that if you start to go down that road, then really you're in an you create an opportunity to deny any science, which essentially is at least striving to fact, whether or not it's fact each time, because we learn and grow and discover new things. But which is what's great. You have a hypothesis, you go to there, and you have another hypothesis, you go to there, and move forward. And I mean, that's just the way it should progress.
Mm-hmm. You know? We're looking at the Mars rover as a potential vice presidential candidate. Mm-hmm.
People like the Mars rover.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well vetted.
Everyone's seen his videos.
You know where she stands?
Yep.
Yeah. On Mars.
Great pictures.
It's true. And you know, like if the president is ever attacked, clearly the Mars rover is safe Mars,
yeah.
Right? Like to take over.
They don't have to fly in two different planes if they're sitting on two different planes.
Not hiding in a mountain
bunker
in Colorado.
Yeah.
No. Too true. Transparency. I mean, talk about the faith and the transparency of the church spending, but I think transparency across the board is kind of an important sort of key part of the Canada Party platform, right? Like the government should by and large be very, very transparent about what it's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the big wool that's been pulled over the eyes too. And you can't blame them. I mean, when the Affordable Care Act came out, you heard of all the complaints about how long it was. So now you even have people in Congress voting for a bill they've never read because it's just a little too bulky for them, you know? And so we realized that how do you expect your electorate to sit down for a week and try to analyze this piece of legislation? It's just not. So we're saying, you know, like drugs and cigarettes, that each new piece of legislation has to clearly state its potential side effects, number one, like we see on the cartons of cigarettes, just so you know. And then the name has to reflect what the actual content is. So we're going to start by renaming the Patriot Act, Fuck You, Thomas Jefferson, which would be far more accurate than, you know, 1,200 pages of the Patriot Act, which basically tells you you're screwed and we'll watch you whatever, which way we can.
For sure. So any hopes of getting a write-in ballot? Has there been any traction in terms of in the states amongst the electorate so far?
Oh, sure. We've gotten
some pretty dedicated folks down there. But,
yeah, we've got quite a fan base all over the place, too. And they keep saying, come to our city. We'd love to have there's a bookstore that would be perfect for, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's all about the finances, about, you know, doing touring and stuff. And we're just coming off a fantastic tour, and we're going to got some more coming up. But so the book's only been out for 6 weeks, so we've got so much more in the planning stages right now. But we have people down there that are printing out our campaign posters and putting them on their lawns, taking pictures and putting it on our Facebook page. We have a guy in Tennessee who printed out one of our campaign posters, taped one to the front of his car, as he had a Mini, taped one to the hood and one to the back window when driving around Memphis with that. So we got some great fans down there, and they're being very supportive. And we try to get people to do that. Our website, AmericaButBetter.com, there's some links on there to our Flickr account that has our high-res campaign posters on them. And we encourage people to, print them out and put them up some places, you know, even better, get them, have our book or the posters or something and hold them up in front of campaign events for other candidates, things like that, and put them on our Facebook, Facebook.com/TheCanadaParty or our Twitter @TheCanadaParty, and just, you know, send these things to us and we'll post them like party people, you know, and put you up there. And we've gotten thousands of followers on Twitter and Facebook now, and we're not even that old, and it's growing every day.
I mean, essentially, we've created a platform, if you will, and we've laid it out for them. So, I mean, we aren't going to be the ones driving a potential write-in somewhere, but if somebody decides, yeah, this is the time, these are some, you know, whether or not it's this particular thing that spurs them to say, yeah, let's make some change here, let's actually take some of this back, which is the whole point, then we would be happy to go down and at least do a stump speech or two.
Yeah, we have a small personal fear that we're going to nader the election, but if that actually happens, we will probably have made enough money off of the books. if it's that big, we'll have enough money to go move to an island and change our names.
Relocation.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Chris, Brian, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having us, man.
Best of luck with the election.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.